so many questions. Who are they? What have they done? What are they doing? Beginning after these messages, an hour-long special devoted to a group that has had a truly positive influence on the face of modern music. Are you ready to explore with us the history of this emphatically affirmative group? The answer is yes. The answer is yes. Any questions for John Anderson?
You're a musical infant. Your first record started giving you rushes. The first kind of record that moved you. What type of music or what's?
Well, there was.
I mean, this is back to grade school.
Oh, right? Yeah. Everly Brothers. Generally, Everly Brothers, because of the kind of harmonizing, the melody lines and things like that. I always liked to listen to kind of very emotional classical music, because I'd listen to it by the radio. Totally. I think Vanilla Fudge's first album was such a breakthrough for a band like that, and it was a very strong influence on a lot of people. And the Nice, again, they used the actual classics to reproduce on stage, and because they were classic pieces of music anyway, just to hear them in a club was heavy. Beach Boys and Stones, Zappa, all pushing. But the Beatles were like a strong pinnacle for millions of people.
John Anderson spent his youth in Lancashire, not far from Liverpool, in northwest central England. From the age of 14, he was performing in cover bands such as The Warriors that mimicked the hits of the day. Later, after a period of traveling in Europe, he had a brief stint of a couple of months with the group Gunn, founded by Paul and Adrian Gurvitz, later of the Baker Gurvitz Army. Gunn was perhaps best known for their minor hit, Race with the Devil. If nothing else, his time with Gunn served to ensconce him in the active London music scene. But it was a short affair, and soon John was hanging out at a Soho nightclub called La Chasse, helping out and socializing with the musicians who would come there after performing. It was there he met Chris Squire. The year was 1968.
And then there was that fateful afternoon. It was just me and Chris in the bar. I was at one end of the bar, and Chris was at the other end of the bar, and we'd never met. And my friend Jack Barry, who now runs the Marquee Club, as it happens, he was managing that Chasse Club. And he said, you've got to come and meet this guy over here. He's a bass player. He's getting a band together. I think you could get it together. And so he introduced us. And we just chatted for about half an hour, and I went round to his house and we sang some songs together. And that's how we realised there was every possibility that we should work together.
Chris Squire was from London, a classically trained musician who had formed his own group at the age of 16 and had spent 2 years in a group called Sin with guitarist Peter Banks. He was ready for a challenge. He and Anderson had a like-minded interest in a more structured, classical, and harmony-based music. They recruited Banks, keyboardist Tony Kaye, who was familiar to them from the Soho music scene, and found Bill Bruford through a newspaper advertisement. John Anderson reasoned that he could tell the quality of the drummer by asking what kind of drums he owned. When Anderson called Bruford, the drummer lied and said he had a quality Ludwig kit. Bruford got the job and painted his drums so that his deception would not be immediately obvious. The brand new band got a few good breaks. In October of that year, they were on hand to fill in at the last minute for Sly and the Family Stone when that group canceled out of a date at London's prestigious Speakeasy Club. On the basis of that gig, they landed a residency at the trendy Marquee Club, and in December got phenomenal exposure opening for the group Cream at their farewell concert in Royal Albert Hall. It was a matter of course that all that exposure would land the innovative new group a recording contract, and by October of the next year, the self-titled debut album was released. Unfortunately for the group, they lacked studio experience and strong management, and were assigned the less-than-extraordinary producer Paul Clay for the sessions. Here's John Anderson again.
We weren't over-sure about what a producer's job was, so we accepted whatever happened. And in retrospect, when we look back at that time, a little bit more musical help, recording-wise, would have helped a lot.
Sunshine is creeping in, and somewhere in a field a life begins. An egg too proud to rape, the beginning of the shape of things to come.
The year 1970 seemed auspicious for Yes. In music, the fusing of classical pretension with rock and roll had made great headway. Groups like Procol Harum and the Moody Blues had made the use of symphony orchestras fashionable. The controversial Jesus Christ Superstar had given new meaning to the phrase rock opera. This boded well for a group that had operatic aspirations of their own. And it was no surprise when in November of that year they released their second album, Time and a Word, and it had full symphony orchestration. Time and a Word was notable for several things. They demonstrated on vinyl their abiding interest in offbeat cover versions of Anderson's favorite American soft rock songs. On this album were densely electrified and orchestrated versions of Richie Havens' No Opportunity Necessary, No Experience Needed. Step out in the night when you're lonely. Listening for the sounds that your ears don't hear. And Every Days by Stephen Stills.
Look at the sad goodbyes. Every day's a killing time. Sun coming up outside, no matter born the star.
Two standout songs, including the moderately successful title single, were co-written by Anderson and a bass player friend named David Foster.
There's a time.
This album also marked the group's introduction to Eddie Offord, who came into the sessions as the recording engineer. In Offord, Yes would find a strong collaborator in album production, and on the next six albums, including the landmarks Fragile and Close to the Edge, he shared producer credits with the band. He had an undeniable influence on the textures and layers of sound that became the Yes trademark. But on their second album, he was just an engineer. The producer was English writer and session man Tony Colton, and orchestral arrangements were by one of London's busiest guns for hire, Tony Cox. His obviously minimal interest in the project irked the band. John Anderson.
Very fine arranger, very well studied arranger. He knew what he was putting down. Possibly didn't have the drive that I would have liked to have seen in someone to really get them guys going. But it was just a matter of course that these things happened and we accepted them.
Thank you. Just after the recording of Time and a Word, guitarist Peter Banks had a falling out with his bandmates and went off to form his own group, Flash. Again, through their music scene connections, they recruited Steve Howe, who had been band-jumping around London, playing with the Syndicat, Bodast, Tomorrow, and other bar bands. Howe was very attractive to Yes, not only because he was classically trained, but also because he was a practiced multi-instrumentalist, a guitar specialist with an emphasis on customized acoustic and pedal steel guitars. He was progressive and proficient, and open to all the same directions the band intended. Interestingly, though he does not play on the album, it is Howe who is seen on the group photo on the cover of the North American release of Time and a Word. His enthusiasm for the project was immediately evident. Within months of his joining the band, they were rehearsing and recording material that included extended instrumental sections he had written. So well received was this new player by their growing English following that a live version of one of his solo instrumentals appeared prominently on side one of their next album. It was not a lack of imagination that led them to call this the Yes album. For many reasons, they considered it their debut.
I think it became the first group album. It wasn't produced by anybody, it wasn't organized by anybody but the group. Mm-hmm. And with getting Steve Howe in the band, it rejuvenated a lot more sense of being what a group is. I could talk to Steve a lot easier about music.
I've seen all good people turn their heads each day, so satisfied I'm on my way.
About my inner self's vision of myself. And interpreting that each person has this soul, if you want to call it a certain thing, that has seen everything that that person is and knows everything about that person. And that's when I sing, though you've seen me, please don't tell a soul. Chris wrote the line, and we co-wrote the lyric. I remember I wrote, "Loneliness is a power that we possess to give a tickler forever." And Chris wrote, "Oh, I know that can be shown by your acceptance of the facts they're shown before you." And then he wrote, "Take what I say in a different way." And it's easy to say that this is all confusion. And then I think I wrote, "As I see a new day in me, I will also show it you, and you may follow." I've always thought that I, me, and you is the listener to the song. It is him, me, I. It was Vietnam at the time, and kids going out there who had to fight, and it's not their fault. They had to fight. They had to get into it. They had to get on top of it, or else they're going to get killed. And they had to get on top of the whole situation. And that's what struck me, that it wasn't a disgrace to fight, even though the most inner feelings of man is that it's the most cruel, degrading, abysmal thing to be doing is to kill your fellow man.
Mutilated, armies gather near.
Despite the positive impact of the Yes album on the group's spirit, the recording sessions revealed a problem. More and more, they saw amongst their contemporaries the impact of expanding keyboard technology. Their progressive peers, like the exciting new Emerson, Lake & Palmer, demonstrated how the new instruments like the Mellotron and the Moog synthesizer could supply that dense orchestral sound they so hungered for. Though Tony Kaye tried to adapt to these changes, he was basically from an older, simpler school of organ-based keyboard playing and felt the technological emphasis tended towards gimmickry and de-emphasized musicianship. Before the recording for the Yes album was completed, he had been asked to leave. By now, the members of Yes were well known in the London scene. King Crimson's Robert Fripp, for example, asked John Anderson to do a guest vocal on their Lizard album. Wake your reason's hollow boat, where your blizzard season cold. Burn a bridge and burn a boat. Stake a lizard by the throat. So it was that when Yes needed to recruit a new keyboard man, they had only to pick from among the many musicians with whom they were familiar. At the time, Rick Wakeman was a hot property. He had entered the prestigious Royal Academy of Music at 16. He cut his teeth recording and performing with the Straubs. Wakeman became a much-in-demand session player, appearing on albums by Cat Stevens, T-Rex. He appeared, along with Steve Howe, on Lou Reed's first solo LP, recorded in England.
In Berlin, by the wall, you were 5'10" tall. It was very nice. Candlelight and Dubonnet on ice.
He was on David Bowie's Hunky Dory. You can readily recognize his signature piano style backing up the Bowie hit Changes.
But never leave the stream of warm and permanent sand. So the days float through my eyes, but still the days seem the same.
When Yes approached Wakeman in 1971, it was like the answer to a prayer. He was offered freedom to exploit his full arsenal of keyboards, including mellotron, harpsichord, and clavinet, and to indulge in all his classical-based fantasies and extended concert solos. Wakeman was the spark the band really needed to shoot for the big time. They had never felt stronger. It was with supreme irony that they named their next album Fragile. Fragile boasted three tracks that became concert favorites: Heart of the Sunrise, Long Distance Runaround, and the song that in an edited version became the only Yes hit single until 1983, Roundabout. Heady self-assuredness was reflected in the inclusion on the album of 5 solo compositions, one by each band member, a reference to their extended solos in concert. Wakeman multi-tracked a Brahms excerpt, no doubt inspired by Walter Carlos's Switched on Bach.
¶¶
Chris Squire's The Fish was similarly based on a piece of multi-tracking wizardry. Bill Bruford made an arrangement based on one of his favorite percussion patterns. John Anderson performed all the voices in We Have Heaven. Only Steve Howe allowed his composition to stand unadorned. Fragile introduced another element to Yes fans, the talent of Roger Dean. Dean was an architect and graphic artist, graduate of the master's program in design at London's Royal College of Art. After doing some interior design work for a London jazz club, he had connected with the music scene and was commissioned to do album art. Ironically, his first cover was for the debut album by the group Gunn, which was recorded not long after they had flirted with John Anderson. His contact in 1971 with Yes proved to be the start of a long and fruitful association. Though he has worked with many bands over the years, it is Yes, perhaps, with which his work is most closely associated. It might be said that the fantasy art of Roger Dean benefits from some kind of synergistic potency when fused to the music of Yes, and that the music is similarly enhanced. Certainly those key albums were rare examples of audiovisual compatibility, as are seldom seen in the recording industry, and as a whole were transporting and fantastical. Though the band had toured the US and Canada as a support act in 1971, in the wake of Fragile a year later, they were able to return as headliners. They unveiled to their new audience yet newer material, material that would later be released as the epic Close to the Edge.
Herman Hesse, and the lyrical content became a kind of dream sequence in a way. The end verse is a dream that I had a long time ago about passing on from this world to another world. It just seemed a matter of course that death being such a beautiful experience for man physical to go through as being born in.
By this time, two trends were becoming evident in public reception to Yes. The critics found their laboring of classical themes pompous and pedantic. They felt that John Anderson's projected personality was unfashionably hippie-like, and they likened him to an effete Donovan. They found his obscure, poetic lyrics so much meaningless drivel, and they took great pains to tell the world. The growing body of the band's appreciative audience, meanwhile, were entranced and engrossed by the group's innovative arrangements, their individual technical prowess matched with their ability to create shimmering walls of seamless texture. Anderson's angelic voice, singing a language that they knew was meant to be felt, not read literally. Did they want more? You know the answer. The answer is yes. We'll continue after this. The answer is yes. And in 1972, two people busy asking themselves a few questions were Peter Banks and Tony Kaye. The previous year, Banks had recorded with his group Flash, which debut had also featured Tony Kaye on keyboards. In 1972, he took a brave shot at solo recording with the album The Two Sides of Peter Banks. Meanwhile, Tony Kaye was busy with his group Badger, a straightforward rock and roll band with a no-nonsense bottom end. On bass was the David Foster who had collaborated with John Anderson on the Yes album. Their one and only album, recorded live at the Rainbow Theater, was published by the Yes company Yes Songs, credits John Anderson as co-producer, and has a spectacular, if inappropriate, cover by Roger Dean. Another man questioning the Wheel of Fortune at this time was Bill Bruford. He had more experimental aspirations than the relatively structured music of Yes was allowing him. He had been dabbling in jazz funk freeform sessions and had found a philosophical confrère in Robert Fripp of King Crimson. When the ever-changing lineup of Crimson completely collapsed after the Lizard album, Fripp went looking for like-minded players to start the group from scratch, and Bill Bruford was on his list. Bruford accepted. His work on King Crimson's Lark's Tongue in Aspic, released the following year, is distinctive and exciting. Enter Alan White, a young session player originally from the North Country. Alan White could be heard on albums by Gary Wright, Joe Cocker, Ginger Baker's Air Force, and George Harrison. He played with John Lennon's Plastic Ono Band when they performed in Toronto in 1969. Like other members of Yes, he was a classically trained percussionist and jumped at the chance to exercise his talent on some more intricate compositions. So it is that the three-record live album set Yes Songs, recorded during tour dates in 1972, includes three tracks on which Bruford plays and 11 with Alan White. In fact, when hired, White had only 3 days to learn all the material before he had to perform in front of 15,000 at a concert in Dallas. Yes Songs featured an extraordinarily expensive package with not only a front and back cover beautifully rendered by Roger Dean, but also no less than 3 full gatefold paintings, plus a full-color booklet. It remains one of the most expensive album designs ever marketed. Also during this period, Rick Wakeman had pooled his resources and produced his first solo album, the much-acclaimed Six Wives of Henry VIII. The album draws on all his studio confederates, with strong help from Alan White and Bill Bruford both, and cameos by Chris Squire, Steve Howe, and even old Straub's leader Dave Cousins. The album did especially well among Yes fans, and his excerpts during solo breaks became concert favorites. Even while they were touring the show that would become Yes Songs, Anderson and Howe were developing the concept that would emerge on the highly ambitious Tales from Topographic Oceans. Based on ideas found in the book Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda, a study of one man's awakening to Eastern mysticism, it is the first album by Yes where the lyrical intention is clearly presented in a lengthy essay on the album sleeve. The words are no less convoluted and obscure, but their spiritual focus is given clear context.
Chase the mid-fusions of wonder in moments hardly seen forgotten. Colored in pastures of chance dancing, these cast spells of challenge, amused but real in thought. We bled from the sea.
The music, however, seems to suffer from dilution, seeming to strain to generate four sides of arrangements to sustain the overall concept. The critics tore this one apart, calling it flaccid and overblown, the natural development of outsized egos playing outmoded music. As always, a few flaws had blinded them to some of Yes's most beautiful music. The tour that supported Topographic Oceans in 1973 brought Roger Dean's involvement up another notch. The stage array that they took around the world featured massive fiberglass sculptures that made it look like some kind of extraterrestrial aquarium. The band entered through a glowing, shell-like tunnel. Towering over Wakeman's keyboards was a massive rack of coral that oscillated with colors in time to his playing. Over the drum kit sat the shell of some titanic crustacean, and at the peak of the show, its shell cracked open to reveal a throbbing organism within. It was astounding and expensive, and problems rose when Dean later tried to market the designs to other bands. The problem was eventually solved when Yes actually went into partnership with Dean on a stage design company, but the huge structures generally proved too expensive for most bands to afford. This business aspect of what had become a weighty corporate enterprise was one reason that soon after this tour, Rick Wakeman decided to undertake his solo career full-time. So it is ironic that the project he immediately embarked upon was easily as grand in scale, and eventually proved even more expensive than anything attempted by Yes. Journey to the Center of the Earth, a musical adaptation of the Jules Verne classic, was recorded live at the Royal Festival Hall in January 1974, with the London Symphony Orchestra, the English Chamber Choir, and the narration of actor David Hemming.
He soon realized that they had reached a world within a world.
The elaborate staging also included huge inflated dinosaur that battled in an orchestra pit filled with dry ice. The concert was a great success, the album a moderate success that, despite some critical nods, generally failed to go gold in most markets for want of a decent single. In a tremendous miscalculation, Wakeman decided to tour the album with the full orchestra and the choir and the dinosaurs. The North American leg of this tour alone, moving this huge entourage from city to city to half-filled concert halls, rapidly ate up all his substantial earnings from Yes, and soon drove him virtually bankrupt. Due to costs incurred mostly on this tour alone, he would in time be forced to sell most of his unparalleled collection of customized and rare keyboard instruments, and undertake a comparatively Spartan lifestyle for years thereafter.
The abyss had opened up, and the sea was pouring into it.
Meanwhile, his old band had been searching for his replacement. For a while, they were interested in Vangelis Odysseus Papathanasiou, who had been a member of a popular Greek group known as Aphrodite's Child. He had come to England, and under the name Vangelis, had been releasing some very powerful albums of keyboard-based music.
At the time, there was this guy called Vangelis whose records I'd listened to, and he had something that really hit me very strongly, and has done ever since. Mm-hmm. So we worked out together, and basically because we were a very strict... We have a strict working relationship that we enjoy, and he was a very loose character. He was possibly the opposite end of the stick to the band. That's possibly why it didn't come about, that we didn't work together. And we would wait until the man came along who was obviously part of the band, who saw himself as part of the band, and that was Patrick.
Patrick Moraz was, of course, classically trained. He had originally come from Switzerland and had made a name for himself in England as a soundtrack composer. His first notable gig was with the group Refugee, which he had formed with percussionist Brian Davison and bass and vocalist Lee Jackson. Davison and Jackson were what was left when Keith Emerson broke up the Nice to form Emerson, Lake & Palmer. Their one album with Moraz, simply titled Refugee, was considered an underground classic in England.
Just look right the canyon wall. Then like an eagle, down we'll fall.
Almost immediately after his work with Refugee in the spring of 1974, Moraz was recruited by Yes to start work on their next album, which turned out to be a potent return to form. In construction, the album Relayer harked back to Close to the Edge. Side one was one long epic, Gates of Delirium, and side two was split into two dissimilar songs, To Be Over and Sound Chaser.
Sound Chaser came out as the strong kind of line of music that was happening around that time, that we were chasing a lot of things, a lot of ideas. We'd still tried to do it, we'd still done the pictorial kind of thing with Gates of Delirium, and then we did the gentle kind of To Be Over affirmation of a lot of things, how we felt about a lot of things.
In the wake of the relative success of Relayer, the members of Yes decided to undertake concerted solo ventures, and most of 1975 was devoted to these projects. Steve Howe was first off the mark with the rather unexceptional and unfocused Beginnings that failed to truly exploit his talents. Helping out were old friends Alan White, Bill Bruford, and Patrick Moraz. Much more impressive was the first and to date only solo effort by one of the principal musical forces of Yes, and the only member of Yes who has been in every incarnation of the group, Chris Squire. The album title refers to the bass solo, which had become a regular feature of Yes concerts, The Fish. He called his debut solo LP, Fish Out of Water. Also to be heard here were Yes associates Bill Bruford and Patrick Moraz. In its orchestration, its melodic strength, its overall quality of composition, this is one of the most underrated of all the Yes-related works. Patrick Moraz's debut solo album, I, was a work of considerable imaginative scope. Recorded in his native Geneva with noted session men Ray Gomez, Jeff Berlin, Alphonse Mouzon, and Andy Newmark, and with South American recording sessions to use the percussionists of Rio de Janeiro, it tells in densely textured polyrhythms a fascinating science fiction story of Moraz's invention. But for pure fantasy, none could match the first solo venture by the group's chief writer. John Anderson was maintaining a strong tie with Vangelis and wrote and sang the words to the one vocal track on his powerful 1975 album, Heaven and Hell.
How we chased a million stars and touched as only one can.
Later, inspired no doubt by his friend's ability to build an album in the studio all on his own, John Anderson crafted Olias of Sunhillo as a completely solo venture, performing all the parts, conceiving every image. The elaborate album graphics by David Rowe contain the basic storyline of the space fantasy epic that fuels the lyrics, that of a gigantic interstellar arc that delivers a group of tribes from off a doomed world. But it is the scintillating washes of Anderson's broadly layered music that generate the exotic atmosphere. It is a singular effort of creation by a man who never had a formal music lesson in his life. Much more poorly received was the effort by Alan White. Ramshackled is in many ways like its title, an uneven hodgepodge of horn-driven rock, R&B, and jazz fusion with the occasional vocal ballad line. It seems to have been mostly to give work to some old friends and is rarely satisfying. The one exception is a song with lyrics that adapt one of William Blake's Songs of Innocence, with guest performances by Steve Howe and John Anderson.
Dark in the sky.
In the summer of 1976, Yes reunited for a grand-scale tour of Europe and North America. It was the only chance anyone had to see a Yes with Patrick Moraz.
Soon, oh soon, the light
reason to be here after these messages? The answer is yes. The answer is yes. The question is one of perpetual change. At the end of 1976, Patrick Moraz had stepped down from the ivory tower of Yes and let the old master return for what would eventually be a 2-year reconciliation with his old bandmates. The album that next boasted Rick Wakeman, Going for the One, would prove to be among their most popular up to that time and showed some intriguing direction changes that were actually quite prophetic. The changes were immediately evident, if somewhat superficially, in the lack of a cover by Roger Dean. For Going for the One, the very trendy arthouse Hypnosis supplied one of their more average photomontages. The music was above average, but also seemed to be trying for that immediate accessibility. It was instantly recognizable, bearing many signature turns of phrase and compositional conventions. But if familiar, it was at the same time somehow more emphatic, more straightforward. There was a solo composition by Chris Squire, the first on a Yes album since Fragile's Fish. There was a track that almost told a straightforward narrative, turn of the century, the tale of a sculptor creating a likeness of his dead lover through which he touches her in spirit. It seemed that they suddenly yearned to just turn down the art and become simple storytellers. They toured the album through the fall and winter of 1977. A tor is a high hill or a pile of rocks on a hill that make it a landmark. In the geomancy of the Stonehenge era druids, the tor were used to mark the direction of ley lines, or lines of power in the earth. In 1978, while studying topographical maps of England that marked all these tor and their ley lines, Anderson was delighted to find one in Devon called Yes. The rest of the group were more delighted to make the obvious play on words and call his find Yes Tor Matto, and that became the name of the next album. The Hypnosis cover shows a man walking near Yes Tor, obviously in the act of trying to find water along the ley lines using divining rods, but the picture has had a ripe tomato thrown at it. This diminution of the Yes visual image from its visionary fantasy vistas to this satiric jab at mystical pretension may be a clear indication of the rather dramatic shift the members were making away from the band's early ideals. The music inside took the changes a step further from Going for the One. Again, there were the nods to the old Yes form, such as in the song Future Times, which they had attempted to compose in the same fashion as Topographic Oceans. But this song was only 4 minutes long, the longest on the album not even 8. In all, Tor Matto had no less than 9 songs. Not since Fragile had so many tracks been heard on a single Yes album. And the words were often so unobscure as to be strident. Tor Matto suffers mostly from what seems to be sloppy, hard-edged, hurried production. There is very little of the sweeping, velvety textures that were their trademark. The only truly transporting moment of melodic magic is to be found on the short song Onward by Chris Squire. And John Anderson had become determined to spin tales of the modern age. No doubt heavily influenced by his 2 children and inspired by the popular culture that they were relating to, he seemed more and more captivated by the romance of simple storytelling. After seeing Close Encounters of the Third Kind, he fantasized on the theme in Arriving UFO.
I could not take it oh so seriously, really, when you called and said you'd seen a UFO.
After reading Ray Bradbury's Something Wicked This Way Comes, he expounded on that book's concept of a mythical circus visiting a small Midwestern American town in Circus of Heaven. At the end of that song, we actually hear the voice of his 4-year-old son Damien, putting the whole thing in perspective.
Was that something beautiful, amazing, wonderful, extraordinary, beautiful?
A lot of Yes fans felt the same way, but the album actually did quite well for the band on the strength of those shorter cuts, easily programmed on the radio. In late 1978 and early 1979, Yes toured probably their most impressive show ever, pioneering a concert in the round concept that came as a revelation to their fans old and new. By removing a static linear relationship between band and audience, they created a concert experience somehow instantly uplifting. Like an illuminated revolving tour, they channeled the energy lines of the audience into a powerful musical focus. Two songs from this tour, three from a 1977 European tour and three from the American tour with Patrick Moraz in 1976, were later compiled and released as the live double album Yes Shows, complete with a return to Roger Dean cover art. But by the time the fans had their hands on this excellent package, it was qualifiable as nostalgia, since in the meantime, Yes had once again indulged in their habit of perpetual change. Rick Wakeman once again bowed out of the Yes project. But he was not the only defector from Yes. Startlingly and beyond expectation, John Anderson let it be known that he would not be involved in the project until further notice. As chief founder, principal author, and main motivator, his defection spelt the end of this musical megalith. In fact, he had just chosen to explore an area that had been extremely attractive to him for many years, lengthy collaboration with good friend Vangelis. The debut album of this exciting new duo, Short Stories, was a refreshing exploitation of both their strengths. Howe had also been active in an extracurricular way, producing his second solo album. In the same fashion that Yes had self-titled their third LP, the Yes Album, and so made it seem like a fresh start, so Howe chose to call this one the Steve Howe Album. It was an extremely impressive blend of styles, from Spanish classical to country boogie, with guest appearances by Bruford, Moraz, Alan White, a 59-piece orchestra, and the beautiful voice of Claire Hamill.
Just look over your shoulder.
And then something happened. It was something strange and unlikely, even absurd, but there it was. It caused Yes fans to rethink everything they knew. It was called Buggles. Key components of the Buggles, who made that sudden splash on the charts in 1980 with Video Killed the Radio Star, was two young London musicians named Trevor Horn and Jeff Downes. It seems that they knew Chris Squire socially, and during a period of Yes's dormancy following Tormato and the departure of Wakeman and Anderson, they had undertaken some experimental jamming with him. Chris Squire liked the vitality of the musicians, though not especially their repertoire as Buggles. The idea was forming in his mind that he would start a new band with these two, make a radical direction change, but remain true to his musical roots at the same time. He wanted to maintain the theatrical aspect that he had enjoyed so much in Yes as well, and when they tossed possible band names around, he suggested cinema or drama. When Steve Howe got wind of Squire's enthusiastic new project, he also asked to sit in, and before long, songs were taking shape. When they looked for a drummer, well, Alan White wasn't busy. Suddenly, Squire realized that for all his original intention, the music they were making was very much Yes music. And no one argued when he suggested the name. Drama became the name of the album. All it took to give the whole concept the final stamp of authenticity was the signature Roger Dean cover. But Yes fans were understandably taken aback to pick up the album and not hear John Anderson.
I am a camera.
The music was strong, it certainly fit the bill, and Trevor Horn's wispy tenor was not a bad match after all, but it buggled their mind. When the new Yes toured the new album in the fall of 1980, they were careful to take out a comparatively simple show, and only to the largest cities, understandably cautious about the world's reception to the act. But Squire had no personal doubts. As if to set everyone else's mind at ease, he included in the lyrics to Tempus Fugit which means time flies, the very first reference in the entire Yes library to the band's name. Didn't it? The answer is yes. The answer is yes. The question is, what can you say about the intervening years? All of the Yes alumni and members have been active and fruitful. Rick Wakeman has produced almost a dozen solo and soundtrack albums. John Anderson has continued to pursue a solo career, having the most success with 1982's Animation. He has also remained active with Vangelis, with one top 10 single in 1981's Friends of Mr. Cairo. Bill Bruford continued with King Crimson until 1978's Red album, joined the short-lived UK, and has gone on to produce some excellent jazz-based albums of his own. Steve Howe formed Asia with John Wetton of King Crimson, Carl Palmer of Emerson, Lake & Palmer, and Jeff Downes. Later, he formed GTR with ex-Genesis guitarist Steve Hackett. And Chris Squire, through it all, remained committed to Yes. With Steve Howe now gone, and with him Jeff Downes, he began his search in 1983 for a new guitarist. He selected Trevor Rabin. Rabin had been born in South Africa, where he had a successful band called Rabbit. He spent time producing albums in Italy and in 1978 recorded his first solo LP in London. Two albums followed, the third produced by Ray Davies of the Kinks. He received producer credits on albums by Manfred Mann and Jack Bruce. Chris Squire liked his style and his voice for those all-important Yes harmonies. For keyboards, Squire ran into original Yes member Tony Kaye in Los Angeles. Kaye had been living there since 1975, had done a tour with Bowie, worked with the band Detective, even done a stint with a reformed Badfinger. He thought he had retired, but when Squire asked, he said yes. In yet another chance encounter, Squire mentioned to John Anderson that the band was once again taking shape. He wouldn't by any remote chance want to sing Yes songs again, would he? "90125" was produced in 1983 by Trevor Horn, so recently a player, and his touch made it a genuine masterpiece with several major radio hits. They toured the album the next year to much acclaim. And now it's 1987, and the same Yes lineup has done it again with a big generator. It's been perpetual change, but it's never been dull. It's never even been ugly. Like its name, it's been one long, affirmative, positive, definitely, assuredly, certainly, absolutely, yes. What was that? The answer is yes. Was produced by Jeff Green in the studios of...
Shea.
1106.
Stranger Media. To find out more about the works of Jeff Green, go to strangermedia.com.